this evening was planned on a sort of informal meeting with friends, but it turned out to be quite popular and therefore sort of formal, but maybe we can make it a bit lighter now. I have a lot of questions, so I was super intrigued by both of your works when I saw it just 2 weeks ago. Because I'm also, I'm working on these topics, and just like the video of Sami mentions, like, how do you sense something that cannot be sensed, or that is, you know, incomprehensible as a human. Thank you. I'm personally also struggling with this. Like, I'm really interested in like these undersea cables connecting continents, or radio waves connecting continents, or, you know, global trade routes. Then and now, what I in my own practice experience is that it's too big to deal with. I mean, you can visit places, that's like one thing that I do a lot. Some time ago, me and Silvio visited this bike graveyard as well. Yeah, it's shown in, essence, shown in your video, Dacian. Mm-hmm. The yellow Sharon bikes piled up in a field. We biked there in, where was it again?
Far, it was far.
It's sort of close.
Was it like in the north of the airport somewhere?
Yeah, it was near the airport.
How do you know where it is?
Via some Twitter research. You're standing there with 5,000 bikes, you know, and then, you know, what you're gonna do is like take a selfie. maybe it's a too big question, but I want to ask you both, like, how can you deal with these sort of larger infrastructures that are like larger than life, and how do you deal with it in your own practice?
Yeah, I don't know. I guess for me, maybe I did some work some years ago on the Internet Archive in San Francisco as well. And I think for me, a lot of the interest in these kind of things beyond the more obvious or interesting historical, larger scale is also when I meet with people and talk with people living around these spaces and working around these spaces. So, like, for example, in that research in the Internet Archive, I spent a lot of time talking to a librarian working there and engineers working in this site, the headquarters, where they have a bunch of servers actually in an old church. It's very crazy in San Francisco. And the film that I made from there was narrated by this librarian, and there was a lot of stories that came from there. So I think maybe for me, at least the way I found to deal with this big topics and infrastructures is kind of like, I guess maybe an anthropological way of seeing it, in a way of like talking to people and focusing on a particular site where maybe I have some direct connection or relation. And I think, I don't know, I saw that also in yours. I think speaking, I mean, this video, like at the beginning, the film was really interesting, but yeah, it's like really about the big things, and then it comes more particular to the Dutch experience, which I think also grounds it a little bit more. I think you always need that, you know, maybe, because it's what people call in research a case study usually, but I think more this relational aspect, like how I am related to these places, also through my own history and through my own, at least in what I showed, you know, as a Colombian researcher in the south of Spain, also, you know, coming from this weird mess of post-colonial identities that is Latin America, how do I relate to that, you know? Also, while talking to people being Colombian, that was already a pre-established relation between me and these engineers and fishermen in this town. So yeah, I think being really aware of that for me is helpful.
Yeah, it's actually kind of interesting, sort of overlap between like the tree or works, tree or you, is that you all use maybe like actors or like a reenactment as a sort of, I don't know, research methodology to figure out how things were and how they work. Maybe you can tell something about it.
Maybe I will talk something about the first question about the infrastructure. Actually I'm focusing on the history of the like the technical history in China rather than the infrastructure itself. Because for instance the first or the second video I've shown actually that is the first I come to that that place, it's very coincident, you know, because that that place is it's behind the light rail station, So and actually, it's like a, how do you say that? It's just a few people live in that place. They are older elder generation. And actually that place, and then I ask to them and know this place in the history is artillery school of China. And also you have seen the yellow the bicycle. Actually they are the broken bicycle, just you know, so and
they were in the same place.
They are in the same place. As for the like the third line construction, and actually the reason why I focusing on that a specific history period, because the third in long time the third front construction is just people say that period of history just like a political era or and leading by Mao or ignore the this period of history, but actually this period of history is very important on the technical development on China, because this the third line construction during 20 years, you know, the 20 years can change many things, especially in the technical way. So I just trace back to that history and try to link the third front construction as a technical base and also the relationship between that history and the technical reality of China in nowadays. So
it's like this what interests me as well is like this repurposing of existing or historical not only infrastructures but also habits or I think it's a very big question. How do these sort of legacies of militarization, colonization, like inform the technology of today? I guess that's for me searching point where it's a big question that maybe cannot be answered now. But it's so bizarre how everything can be traced back in a way. How do you see this like in a practical, manifestation of these historical events? Or?
Yeah, I think maybe thinking about the bunker, like as a place where these dynamics happen. I think what's interesting to me is that, you know, there's like one narrative of colonialism, but it's about interconnectivity of the world, right? And I think a lot of people, at least in Spain, still believe in this idea of like the big Hispanic nation, right? And like, oh, it's great, we can all talk to each other. It's like huge Latin American Spain, right? And I think the internet has this very similar narrative to it, right? About like flow of information and open global communities that can have a similar language. And I think what these infrastructures like bunkers and all these military watchtowers and whatever show us or reveal is that the act of connectivity is always, maybe, I don't know if it depends or relies, or it's always co-produced by an act of like frontier making and of like administering that flow, right? So the same with refugees when I was seeing there, it's like there's this border and the border is porous to data and merchandise and, you know, consumer goods, but then it's like completely blocked for these refugees, right? And in this coast of Spain, there's a bunch of boats, piraguas, like that come from West Africa or from the Canary Islands that are washed off by the sea and, you know, like people sinking in the sea. So I think that was kind of like the same thing with a lot of colonial infrastructures in ships. And I think it's similar in how we think about or how the internet operates. There's all of these different borders and frontiers and firewalls and whatever, all kinds of walls. But I think what's interesting to see about that also is how porous they are, right? They're not like completely static, you know? For example, the interesting thing for me about these songs of coming and going was that, you know, they're unplanned outcomes of that network, you know? And trafficking, you know? I mean, the port of Rotterdam is like, like how many things come through this like fucking port that are not intended to, and they do. And the internet also kind of has this porous to it. So I think that military history is that, you know, the creation of walls, frontiers, but then also like the possibility of finding, I don't know, like other ways of jumping or going under or around. I don't know.
What do you
yeah,
in relation to the like third front?
Yeah. Yeah, I just bring this question to my practice, and yeah, for instance, how to say, Chongqing, actually it's a long time it played a role of the rear guard of China, you know. For instance, when in the history, because Chongqing also is the capital of the wartime China, yeah. When the country maybe faced to some like potential threats or something like that, and the government will like move like some industries or from coastal city coastal land to the southwest of China, and also. Yeah, and nowadays Chongqing is famous in China because of its, for example, it's a very important AI industries in Chongqing, and also Chongqing is the largest laptop. Yeah, I guess you know that it is the largest laptop manufacturer things. In Chongqing, so yeah, people just see some many people just see some like the positive way from these things, and also for me, I think the whole country and many Chinese people really enjoy immersed in the like the technology worship or something like that. So I for that reason, I think trace back to the history seems very important. Mm. Yeah, from that way, and sorry, I forgot that question. Is that I don't know if that clear about
I don't know if there's an answer as well.
Maybe it's not an answer.
Maybe something specific about the Chongqing Work Institute.
Mm-hmm.
Like you mentioned, or you choose to be like self-organized.
Mm-hmm.
Can you maybe explain why you had the need or the want to do this yourself?
Uh-huh.
With a group of people?
Okay, yeah. Yeah, first of all, personally, I'm not birthed on Chongqing. My hometown is in the east of China, and for many people, for me, it's totally different from this area. Yeah, so first time I come to Chongqing just for study, because I have my bachelor and in Sichuan Fine Arts Institute, and the first time I moved to Chongqing, I just think that is totally different. That is the first and also it because it has very special a very special geography. And so and I just do some artwork and based on contemporary art, and also I just meet some artist friend working on Chongqing, and we talking many things, and just found we have like the common interests, like the technical history and something like that. So and also very interested in the urban space of Chongqing, and so we just divide to do something on that city. Yeah, and also at first we just only focusing on this the urban space, and then we bring more specific topics, and so that's just the start of the Chongqing Work Institute, and
So how do you deal with censorship and the Chinese government not really figuring out that your work is quite political,
mm-hmm.
right? In a way, but
So
yes,
yeah.
How do you deal with censorship or the huge?
Yeah, actually,
not allowing freedom of speech.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, actually, it's okay, because
mm-hmm.
That is also the reason why we, mainly focusing on the history,
historical
part.
Yes,
view.
That kind of goes.
Yeah, because something more complexity things is can be behind the
mm-hmm.
this history narrative.
Mm-hmm.
So for the censorship is. It's okay. We haven't met, but for the Chongqing Work Institute, because we also have the physical space,
mm-hmm.
and it's just one time. Yeah, we just
you show once publicly.
Because it's in China, if a space or something like that gathering
yeah.
too many people, and
yeah,
we'll
yeah.
have yeah so
that's why you also present on the location. It's
and that is one reason, and And also we just want to use some like the social media things to present, because Chongqing and we can present some project with the environment or something like that. So yeah,
I read on the website using the environment as a slideshow.
yeah we think that can be more vivid and
yeah.
So I was wondering, you know, if the Digital Silk Road initiative of China building all this crazy like undersea thing, also if they have like a base in Chongqing.
I don't know if you said it's about the PACE. Do you know that it's under a submarine cable?
Yeah, I read about the Digital Silk Road initiative, which is like a bunch of cables owned by China that are being put around the world right now to create parallel infrastructure.
Yeah.
To like competition to Google and Facebook.
I just recently focusing on that, interested in the like the submarine cable in China. I only know about the PACE. It's called the peace cable. You know, it's connect. Actually, it's a P is means from Pakistan to East Africa and to the Europe. Connect to Europe, and just the connection, connect with the French city,
Marseille.
So I think it's very
a funny thing actually. Like, there's this, the submarine cable map, which is quite famous and easily accessible. But I've been trying to find like maps of land-based cables, and it's almost impossible. Mm-hmm. Like, there's no one place you can go. It's only like separated projects. If you know the name, you can find it.
Yeah. Once I tried, I was really interested to find out the land cables in Colombia, and I went to the Ministry of Telecommunications and Information finally after many months of trying to get in touch with them, and they said they don't have access to the information. Like, the ministry doesn't know, because when they open the licenses, when the private company gets the license to build the new cable on land, they're not required to tell the state where they are, especially in Colombia, because there's a huge history of like guerrillas blowing pipelines for oil. So they're really worried about that like cables will be blown by like the war. So nobody knows, only the companies which are mostly Telefónica and Claro from Mexico. It's like super obscure. Land cables are very much more obscure than submarine cables.
Exactly. Yeah. So I guess this is also different for every, country, I guess. Cause, like in the US, most of the internet backbone cables are run along the train tracks, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but that's actually also what I know the case in Europe also. Because you already have a preset like straight even levels flat. So if you look next to the train tracks, you can find like concrete culverts, and that's normally where they put the communication cables.
Right. Yeah.
That's a story like someone digs in the garden and then they dig up like I think it was like Romania or somebody grandmother was digging in her garden, like cut the entire internet connection in like one country. But also like power cables, they also put them close to like old river channel systems because they can use passive cooling. So it's kind of the same, reusing older infrastructure and communication channels, like channels and then...
Channels.
Channels. Channel of information.
Then Colombiano, at least they're put next to oil pipelines usually, or which are also put next to rivers.
Yeah, you mean the people with like CBD build up, maybe the finish the building, build the cave maybe closed. I don't know. So
in this bunker, it's funny because So when I first started going, once I put a camera in front of the gate, the entrance gate, and then all of a sudden I heard this voice on an intercom being like, "Hey, what are you doing? Like, get out, you can't film here." And I was like, oh wow, like, you know, they were looking at me, I was looking at them, they were super anxious. So I think there's still a lot of anxiety about getting filmed and whatever. And the engineer told me, like, yeah, you know, like, how do we know you're not working for the Russians? That was his, like, rationale. And eventually I was able to get in, and they didn't allow me to take pictures. But in fact, in 2012, Conil organized a bunch of touristic trips inside the bunker, because one of the engineers thought it was a good idea to, like, demystify what was going on in there. And I think that slowly this infrastructure in particular, but I think maybe some other information infrastructures are turning into touristic sites. So there's some videos you can find online of people going in and being like, oh wow, look, this is how it works. And, you know, all very, like, curated and like curated content. But yeah, apparently now when I went, they didn't like cameras inside.
Maybe you could run your own tour.
Yeah, maybe. And then I tried to reach back to them. I wrote an official email after that visit, which was more informal, like, hey, I'm doing this project, can you let me in? I want to, like, film. They said no, like, and the engineer told me, please anonymize me in whatever you're writing, because I could get in trouble if they find out I let you in, because I shouldn't have. Yeah, I think it's kind of absurd, to be honest. I mean, there's nothing weird there, but I think there's a lot of anxiety still about someone, you know. I think post also 9/11 kind of anxiety and paranoia, you know, before it was like nuclear bombs, now it's just like everybody could be a terrorist, especially if you're an immigrant, maybe.
Yeah. It's interesting that paranoia, like, extends beyond these frontier areas to, as you're talking about in Colombia, the paranoia about knowing where the cables are under the land.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. So it's maybe not just sort of centered upon the frontier area, but also upon the
mm-hmm.
Mm.
I think there's some questions over there.
I have a question. You work at the Internet Archive? What did you do, and is there traces?
Yeah, I made a film called The Blue Dot about something that I did in the Internet Archive. I mean, I got there because I was documenting indigenous written performances, dances, and things in the Bay Area. There's like 10 identified indigenous groups that are still ongoing, and we wanted to archive this thing somewhere. And we're like, oh, where? Ah, the Internet Archive. So I went and told them, and then I saw this, like, church full of data, like the hard drives blinking, and I was like, what? Is, like, I was hallucinating. So I just went and filmed it.
The Blue Dot.
Yeah, the Blue Dot. It's
Thank
called
you.
The Blue Dot. Yeah.
Can we watch it somewhere?
Yeah, somewhere. Yeah. Nice. It's on the internet.
Yeah, one of the things you were saying at the end was, like, the infrastructure isn't going anywhere, something like that at the end, like, or the ruins aren't going to be, you know, we're going to keep using this on whatever, you know, the cables. Yeah, and that really hit me, because it's so frustrating in a sense, and something I'm struggling with. I think we struggle at Avaria as well a bit, like recently we had this WhatsApp outage, you know, the app was just gone for everybody, and it was like, just like people who I know, like neighbors and stuff who aren't really like in technology scene or whatever, they just use their phone, were like, you know, laughing at it, and then kind of put their phone down and just kind of did other stuff for the day, you know? And they just went off, and yeah, instead of like writing, they went and knocked on the door, and you know, but it came back pretty fast, so. It wasn't really like, you know, really a long moment to like question, you know, the infrastructures and stuff like that, right? But yeah, it just seems like we're missing a chance there. Like a lot of what we do at Varia and I do with other groups is like explore like what would happen if we self-managed like the digital things like servers and tools and we set up our own internets on a local basis, etc. And like, we're not really, I'm not interested in putting people, you know, having people spend more time in front of computers or like everyone should learn to code for geology and all that really slippery, dodgy road, you know, like, or sell a better app or anything to do with that, you know. It's like, we just see, maybe we would just do other stuff if we were involved with running it, right? And so it doesn't seem like, yeah, so after the WhatsApp thing happened, it was like, oh, it's broken, great, you know, like, we could do something else. But then it came back to work. So it doesn't seem like just trying to, like, wait for it to become a ruin is ever going to work out. In the sense that we're trying to do self-managed stuff. So this was great to hear, because it seems like, right, we need to build somewhat of imaginary to, you know, technology as fact. Thing is really difficult to beat. Yeah, this was really cool. Like, this, you know, I'm thinking again of the Dutch experience, like how to bring in this, like, neo-colonial aspect to just, yeah, again, discussion point.
Yeah, I think with infrastructures, I mean, the typical saying is, you know, you don't notice an infrastructure until it stops working, no? That's when you really notice that there's something, you know, like your light goes off and you start looking for the switches and, you know. But I think, you know, that's also an experience very much in the Western parts, westernized parts of the world, because I think a lot of people just live in these ruins, you know. And you can see that cycle, at least with electronics, you know, this, you know, Abogloshi, the biggest e-waste dump in Ghana, which is like huge and crazy. And in Colombia, there's a big one in the north as well, in the border with Venezuela. You know, like, the materials get extracted from here, you know, these minerals, and they get used, and then they come back here, and people live and repurpose these things just because it's like, what else, you know, like, it's like a survival mode as well. So I don't know where I'm going with that, but I think, yeah, like, breaking away from that chain, realizing that infrastructure depends on that, and maybe thinking about the ruin from that perspective of also, like, how ruins are created here, but then kind of, like, sent away, you know,
that's,
like,
a really good point.
Exporting ruins. Yeah,
that's totally EU-centric view, and I'm working lately, like, with this infrastructure with people who are based in Indonesia, and, like, we're working together to, like, stand up some apps to run together and play around with stuff, and, like, they just can't load the pages, you know, and it's like, the stuff we take for granted here just doesn't work there at all, and it's like, this is useless, you know. but here it just works, and so it's like, yeah, it's going, it's hard to see, yeah, as you said, the ruins that are already there. Yeah, I don't know, it's just inspired by your comment.
Maybe a follow-up on this point. You ended up your presentation with this idea of, like, a cautionary tale, like seeing Atlantis as a cautionary tale. Cautionary tale for whom? Like, who do you think is, like, the main public to make sense and make made aware of, like, the risks? So do you have any more precise targets for this kind of narrative?
That's a good question. I don't know. I haven't thought about that much, but I think, I mean, it's like a Greco-Roman narrative. It's like this origin of, or at least the mythological origin of a lot of Western thought, philosophically speaking. And so I think, yeah, like, you know, back then the point of this Atlantis narrative was a lot of, like, a cautionary tale for, like, misusing resources and technology back then, because there was already this issue with, like, the Mediterranean world in terms of, like, wars and dominance and colonization, you know, and expansion. So I think it's like a cautionary tale for, like, the, yeah, I don't know, like, the colonial mindset, you know, the like the expansion, like the exploration / exploitation mindset, that, you know. And now, for example, with the deep sea, like, let's explore the deep sea, but that exploring is deep sea mining. It's turning into deep sea mining like this, you know. So I think it's, yeah, I think maybe it's for that, generally speaking, you know. I mean, I think there's people who do this kind of crap everywhere. I don't think it's, like, localized, you know. I mean, it is, but it's not. It's also the nature of multinationals, but But of course they're not going to see this, so I don't know.
Thank you.
You mentioned some like myths of things that were happening in the bunker in Konya. Like people speculating that there were things happening there. Like, can you give some examples?
Yeah, well, the theory, and I was interested in knowing more about the myth you were saying there in Chongqing as well. But yeah, I mean, there was, I found this found footage of this news reel. The local people, the fishermen, found this like footprints in the beach, and they said that they saw these lights at night and like people in these crazy suits, and they were like, aliens are visiting us, and like, you know, crazy. And it's all about, they're really obsessed about the infrastructure. Konida is like full of towers, telecommunication towers, but telecommunication infrastructure. And people have protested a lot against this because they, you know, cancer and land, like they're always on the street and they want the bunker to be turned off. And they said that aliens were coming to Konin because of that, you know, because like the radio waves or something was calling them. And eventually they found out, even though some people think this is just like a cover-up story, it was scuba divers repairing the cable at night. And they left this huge footprints because of the boots, the scuba divers' boots. But you know, it's like funny, and it's like, you know, you can be like this silly people, but I think there's a lot of truth in a lot of these appropriations of these technological narratives, because it says a lot about like what these people are concerned, you know, like about living immersed in this like crazy antenna, cable, bunker space, you know, without really a choice or a say on it. Yeah, I guess you could replace aliens with Telefonica really easily, you know? I mean, they were the aliens, these like telecommunication company workers. Like, those are the aliens. Just like Columbus was a fucking alien, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's also why one of the reasons that it really hides itself on towers now, like on trees, fake concrete trees or your own building, so it's less scary or more invisible of the whole, you know, infrastructure. And then I think also very interesting a point of talking about exploration, but then it's not only just horizontal, but also could be vertical. If you think about you know, how far or in what level that we took advantage of electricity and internet connections. And as if everything's built on top of that. So if you think about, okay, once the, it just like, okay, maybe some of the cable broken or, I don't know, earthquake. And then, okay, nobody goes to work anymore. What about, you know, online working? Or if there are power outage, you have no running water anymore. Like in the old days, if you think about civilization, okay, you can sort of basically, I don't have a light without electricity, right? You somehow have, I don't know, some stove or coil going on, and you still have running water from the wells, per se. But if you think about if you're living a city without like simple just electricity, means that there are no pumps and no water and no food, no computer. So I'm also thinking about, at some point, slowly, we're also more reliant on infrastructure in a way that things get more fragile or more reliable of how well it was built and who built it and who maintained it and the power and the distribution. Of course, the map you mentioned and everything is rather hidden. For some of the reason is very for security reason, but some of them are just hidden for unknown reasons, or there are conflicts and by that is really, yeah, something we don't know. I remember it could be just very simple dig of repairman and the whole building will just lost the connection of the internet because some handyman just dig up the whole, you know. And then I saw it was just simple repair and it could be just bring down the whole internet for the whole street of the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
So at some point, you're wondering how many cables are patched or built or left behind or unknown. You know, I don't know. It sounds like really crazy to think about all the stuff we left behind that is kind of not functioning after, I don't know, maybe 100 years.
It would be really nice to repurpose them.
Yeah, I mean, in an apocalyptic reality that, you know, will there any old technology or telecommunication can be, you know, repurposed?
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of other technologies still work, you know, and they're like struggling to keep alive in the face of this heavy monopoly of the internet. I think that's a great thing to think about and experiment with, you know, because I think they're there. I don't think we need to reinvent anything. I think a lot of people communicate at a distance using other kinds of things that are not cables, more like telepathy.
Actually, a question for both of you, actually. You both are working with, you were saying this before, Des, like you're both working with really serious, factually heavy topics. Why do you think it's important to use fiction and mythology to address them? Or do you, maybe?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. Yeah, I just thinking about the things. Yeah, for instance, as for the last work I show, actually it's not successful. It's just talking about that place. Actually, the I said the mythology of that place. It is my mythology of that place. It's the origin of that place, because that place is called Beibei, and in Chinese is the mythology is a man who want to cross the river, and he just back a boat and want to cross the river. And why he act that as that, because he, according to he hear the like a guard or something like that, told him to do that, and when and told him do not turn back his head, but when he crossed to the middle of the river, he just very curious, and he turned back his, and he just become a stone. And that is the name origin of that city. And so in the there is a piece of that work is a man. I just introduce a man, and he just talking about the landscape of the mountain or something like that. And actually he used the feng shui. I don't know if you know, feng shui is a kind of technology. I think geomancy. According to the position of the star or the moon or the mountain, and to decide which place is good. And for example, he just talk about the dragon vein of that mountain, of that place. And so that is back to your question. I think that is present a kind of cosmology of Chinese people, and actually in different place of China, in different region of China, they have different cosmology or cosmogram. So I think that things can also discussing into the technology thing we're talking about, because that truly construct the technical the reality, you know. So Yeah, for example, in Chongqing, there's many like the, we can see the smart city, and behind that we can see many like a pre-modern agriculture things like that, and they maybe they just according to their own perspectives to see the whole things happen, to see the reality. So yeah, so I think for me that is both of them are really important, yeah, and it's all combined construct the reality and the complexity we can, yeah, and also like a different modernity, yeah.
I think it relates a lot to like this idea of cosmologies. I think a lot of technology, which is really a way of like affecting the world, comes from like the narrative imagination of thinking of what could be possible. And I think shifting our compass of what is possible is really important to really be able to develop other kinds of technologies, because I think if we can't imagine them, like how could we ever make them possible? And for example, with the Digital Silk Road, I've been reading a little bit about this. And I think it's very interesting because actually, you know, the Silk Road that like Marco Polo like traveled through China, whatever. The writings that he did when he came back, which were this crazy like writing speaking about like the East, you know, the Far East. That's, and he spoke about these two islands, Sipango and I forget the other one, and about how much gold was in them. That's what inspired the Spanish crown to be like, let's go and find this fucking thing. And that's what ended up generating, you know, this whole moment of colonization. So in a parallel to now, I'm like, what dreams or chimeras will this digital Silk Road engender, you know, like, now that gold is not gold, but like data, it's like the new gold. And I think these kind of narratives that are still so present in this technological development say so much about like the end goal that a lot of governments, multinationals have of what technology should be for. And I think, yeah, I think mythology, storytelling, I think it's really important to shift, you know, these priorities or these narratives.
I just add some. And also, I think, when I could say, want to do the research about the technical history of China, it cannot bypass that way. I mean, like the history of the technical development and the mythology. So, yeah, and yeah, I can also recommend an author. I think a philosopher, technical philosopher, Chinese technical philosopher. I think is named Yu Kui. Yu Kui. Because his things also very inspire my work. So, and he just talking many things about the trace back to the ancient China and to the modern day.
Thank you for the
recommendation.
Yeah, he just released his book on cosmotechnics.
Yeah. He talked very clearly about this whole history.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Another book for the time. More questions? Do you have questions for the audience? Now is your chance.
Yeah.
Are you tired? It's been like 3 hours now. I am tired.
Yeah, because many questions they have asked. So I think maybe I will think about it and I can just
maybe we can have a break. We can have a beer and a drink and some snacks and some
great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.